Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm glad so many of you made it back from lunch right on time, and you're going to be rewarded for that. We have a great talk coming up this afternoon. Next slide. Oh, I guess I do that. The first talk this afternoon is from Turner Overton, who's a professor of medicine at UAB. You heard a little bit from him when he was on the panel around antiretrovirals. He'll be discussing cardiovascular disease and the management of HIV.
Thanks, Dr. Cheever, and hi, everybody. So I brought Touchdown Gumby just to get us through. So, Turner Overton from UAB. It's really a pleasure to be here. It's really nice to meet with people and talk with people who are, doing the frontline work that we all try to do. And so hopefully in the next 30 minutes, we'll talk a little bit about cardiovascular disease and really have some practical information that you can use in your practice. Furthermore, I have a breakout session this afternoon. The most recent guidelines for cardiovascular disease risk management were updated in October. And I think it's nice because the two big groups who do risk management, the NLA as well as the ACC, AHA, have come together to try to bring their two recommending panels together. And I think it really helps us as we move forward taking care of patients. And one nice thing is they actually recognize HIV, which is a relatively new occurrence for some of our subspecialists in their guidelines. So I'll try to distill that as well this afternoon. Here we go. So these are my sins, per se. So hopefully you'll all be familiar. I think first and foremost is understanding the problem. So we'll talk about the epi behind cardiovascular disease and HIV, and then talk about the risk factors in HIV. And this isn't rocket science. We really need to be practical in our approaches. And then hopefully come away with the notion that we need to be patient-centered in terms of our approach to cardiovascular disease prevention. So I like to stop first and remind myself what the goal is in our clinic. And first and foremost, our goal should be to treat people's HIV disease. So I give you a snapshot here of our clinic, the 1917 clinic at UAB, and I really feel extremely fortunate to work there. As you can see, we've had a growing number of patients seen in the last 12 months. I've pulled the data from July. We now see we have 3,500 active patients, a little bit more if you include the inactive patients, as Dr. Sag mentioned earlier. And what is, what's amazing is our team, despite having patients who face many challenges, 96% of our patients are on antiretroviral therapy, and 90% are below 200 copies in terms of their viral load. So we're really having tremendous success, and part of that success is our approach. Part of it is really our team model. We have a couple of different talks later in the week, if you or your clinic staff are here, talking about programs leveraging program income that may be very relevant to how do you achieve these goals. We have one on a housing initiative, one on a nutrition initiative, and really recognizing that we need to address the whole patient and not just be looking at what's the viral load. And if we can help them overcome these other issues, we may improve their overall health. Another big thing for us is once we were able to achieve high levels of suppression, we need to identify people earlier and get them plugged into care earlier. And so once again, here is data from the last decade in our clinic. And what you can see is new patients coming into care. The CD4 count is rising. Now you see two lines there. The red line really reflects new patients who are not on antiretroviral therapy, where the blue line is all patients. Obviously, we have some transfers, and those people are often already on therapy. But you can see an increase from 213, a median of 213, to now a median of 353. So this is really important as well, and it's when I come back and talk a little bit about cardiovascular disease risk. If we can get people on therapy earlier, that may be a big benefit in terms of reducing their risk for cardiovascular disease. And if we didn't have these successes with antiretroviral therapy and their immune function, then we wouldn't be talking about end-organ disease. But because we are having such success, it's really important that we talk about the comorbidities that are facing our patients now. Diabetes, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, frailty. As our patients age, these are the diseases that we're going to be seeing. And you know, frankly, I tell many of my patients, there went Gumby. You know, I think he suffered worse. I think that, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, we need to be addressing these things, because it's one thing if we improve our patient's lifespan, but now we need to be moving on to this term called health span, which I'm sure you guys are hearing about. I know that in the last session, people were talking about aging, and I think that's a big issue that we face. So I'm going to start with a case, and I hope you have your question and answer. I hope I have some good music. I'm going to be disappointed if Dr. Sag got better music than I. So here we have a 45-year-old man who presents for care. He's got a BMI of 24.5. His blood pressure is 145 over 86, and he does not exercise. His CD4 count is 325, and his viral load is 42,000. You can see his lipid panel there. Notably, his HDL cholesterol is quite low at 25 milligrams per deciliter. His LDL is not terrible at 125 milligrams per deciliter. So what's the most important intervention to reduce his cardiovascular disease? Was I supposed to press that? Yes. Okay. So you have smoking cessation, initiate the Mediterranean diet, initiate statin, initiate a daily aspirin, or initiate antiretroviral therapy. If you could do one thing, what would it be? I'm not happy with my music choice. Okay, so this is not common. Many people really focus in on the smoking, and hopefully I will get you to recognize. I think one of the things is all of these things would be reasonable to talk about, but hopefully you'll come away with recognizing the first and foremost thing that we should do is get people on antiretroviral therapy and suppress their HIV virus, although smoking is very important. Here's some data that comes out. So I want to talk a little bit about the epidemiology of cardiovascular disease and HIV. And so this is data that comes from the New York Department of Health, published in 2016 in CID. They also have some very interesting data now they publish on cancer as well. And so what they have is they have really good epi data on everybody living with HIV in the five boroughs. And what they can do is they can pull that data and then look at various important parameters, and here they're looking at all-cause mortality. And so the first thing that you can see is they have a large number of participants followed from 2001 to 2012, and despite overall mortality declining in the HIV population, there was an increase, a 50% increase in cardiovascular disease mortality. So if you look here in the top, as many of us are seeing in our clinics, what we're having is a decline in HIV-related, AIDS-related events, but an increase in things like cardiovascular disease and cancers. And this has been a significant increase in terms of cardiovascular disease mortality. From data that came from this same group, they looked at the HIV uninfected, and there was a striking decline in terms of cardiovascular disease mortality. So that really tells us that there's something going on here that's different among our patients. And when they looked at a key risk factor, the first thing that stuck out, they looked at the people who were fully suppressed with a viral load less than 400 or people that had any time during this period a viral load greater than 400. And you see a striking difference. People who had detectable viremia at any time during this period had a twofold increase of cardiovascular related mortality. So it really speaks to the fact that if we can control viremia, we can reduce cardiovascular disease and cardiovascular disease mortality. The thing to remember, though, is there is still a difference with those people who are aviremic compared to the general population. So it's not enough alone, or maybe there's some residual effect. And I think that's one thing that we need to understand. What are the drivers that are independent of traditional risk factors that we see in HIV? So there have been many, many studies now that have shown that cardiovascular disease, the lifetime burden, is about 1.5 to 2-fold increased in HIV populations when compared to the general population. In fact, some people have gone on to say that HIV carries the same risk as traditional risk factors like hypertension, like diabetes, like hyperlipidemia. And it increases the risk not only for cardiovascular disease that we traditionally think of, strokes and heart attacks, but also for things that are similar or in the same vein. So congestive heart failure is something that we're really starting to understand, and how does HIV contribute to that? Pulmonary hypertension with its with significant long-term consequences in health, and venous thrombosis, whether we're talking about pulmonary embolism or, you know, deep venous thrombosis. So these are issues that are related to the same process of vascular inflammation. And so if you look here, this is a nice from a summary article from Priscilla Hsu, where she took the Interheart study, which was HIV negative individuals in the blue, and what you can see is these traditional risk factors convey a 2.5 to 4-fold increase odds ratio of having a cardiovascular event. And then Dr. Shaw et al. Had a similar study where they looked at HIV where you had a 2.2 increased relative risk. So these are actually quite similar. Relative risk is a more conservative estimate of risk. Regardless, you can see HIV is similar to these other risk factors that we've grown accustomed to addressing in cardiovascular disease. Matt Feinstein from Northwestern in Chicago has pulled the data from the CDC, which takes data from all reporting states in the U.S., and looked at both HIV positive and HIV negative. And while cardiovascular disease in the HIV negative group has declined over the period that he looked from 1999 to 2013, what you can see for both men and women living with HIV, a striking increase, a doubling from 2 to 4% in women, and even greater in men from 2 to 5%. So an increasing burden of cardiovascular disease-related death in the setting of HIV. And so a big question that we need to look at is what are the challenges that we're facing with regard to vascular disease in our patients? And so really it's probably multifactorial. I wish it were one simple thing and we could just target that and be done. But really, it's a pretty complicated interplay between traditional risk factors, some of which, like smoking, are enriched in our patient population, but also hypertension, diabetes as well, HIV-specific risk factors. And this predominantly relates to the consequences of chronic viral infection. And so you get excess inflammation and immune activation while you're trying to clear that infection. But unfortunately, in the setting of HIV, where you're unable to be successful, you're left with residual inflammation. And we see some residual inflammation still in our patients who are fully suppressed. There may be antiretroviral therapy toxicities that we need to address. Our newer agents are much cleaner than the old ones, but nevertheless, there may be consequences. Certain behaviors, I already mentioned smoking, sedentary lifestyle, dietary patterns, these may have big implications. And then there are disparities. So many of our patients face challenges because of socioeconomic status, mental health, and other issues that have implications for cardiovascular disease. And so there may be special needs for our patients that are highly relevant. A big thing that I think comes through, and this is not just for HIV, but for a lot of different diseases, and rheumatoid arthritis is one that's been highly recognized as conveying an excess risk of cardiovascular disease, is the inflammation hypothesis. And so I think this works well for HIV, and it's highly applicable. Regardless of what that stimulus might be, whether that's HIV, alcohol, excess oxidized LDL, this drives a process driving inflammation. And so the body has a normal response for these stimuli. In a normal response where you clear the pathogen or the whatever the stimulus is, like influenza, you get a high amount of inflammation, you clear the pathogen, you terminate that stimulus, and healing ensues. In a situation with chronic HIV or someone who has excess high LDL, you're left with ongoing inflammation that can cause then cell death, cell fibrosis, and whatever the end organ disease manifestation that we have. In this case, we're talking about cardiovascular disease, but many other diseases, including Alzheimer's, diabetes, and others, have this sort of paradigm. And so if we think about HIV as that stimulus, what you see is this chronic inflammation, even low-grade inflammation with controlled HIV, leading to these end-organ disease that we're seeing, heart disease, kidney disease, neurocognitive impairment, NASH and NAFLD, and then frailty is another big one, similarly driven in part at least by chronic inflammation. Okay, so what does that mean, chronic inflammation, particularly from a vascular standpoint? So I've taken a couple of images from studies that I've been a part of and had the good fortune to work with really bright people. And so this is a coronary angiogram, a coronary CT angiogram, where they took images of the coronaries, and you can actually look and see what's going on. And so in both of these studies, both of them actually had a FDG PET, where you can see how much inflammation is in the vessels. And in the HIV patients versus the HIV negative controls, there were significantly greater metabolically active active macrophages that are driving the process in the vessels. But when we look at the CT, what you can see are features of high-risk atherosclerotic plaques were present in more in HIV than HIV negative. And so I've just highlighted three of those. I think low attenuation plaque is the easiest one for people to recognize. So when you look, you can see the normal vessel as the dye passes through, and you see this area of low attenuation. And this usually reflects a plaque, an acentric plaque, with lots of rich foam cells and a fibrous cap. And this is what is actually at high risk to rupture. And other features that may make that more likely to rupture and cause a myocardial infarction are positively remodeled plaques, where the vessel lumen at the site of the plaque is greater than the vessel lumen either right adjacent to that, or what we call spotty calcifications, where throughout the vessel you will see these areas like this where you see spotty calcifications. And so these three features are all increased in the setting of HIV, really suggesting there's ongoing inflammation contributing to this process. So what are the potential interventions beyond suppressive antiretroviral therapy? And I really want to try to be more practical in this because I think that there are many therapies that are coming out for the treatment of cardiovascular, even the prevention of cardiovascular disease, more secondary prevention, but these may not be applicable or available to our patients. So some of these are very simple. Smoking cessation, lifestyle changes, antiretroviral switch if you think the antiretroviral therapy is contributing, lipid-lowering therapy, particularly statins, and then other traditional risk factors. So I think I have an audience response question to make sure you're not asleep. Okay, so in suppressed patients with a history of a myocardial infarction, which statement about statin use is accurate? So persons on antiretroviral therapy should avoid statin therapy given the overlapping toxicity. Simvastatin is the preferred statin for persons on antiretroviral therapy. Statin dosing is the same for persons with HIV as the general population. HIV protease inhibitors interact with some statins and increase the risk of statin-related adverse events. And finally, in HIV, statin therapy is used to raise HDL since LDL is not a reliable measure in the setting of HIV. Okay, excellent. I will just say for the fact of discussion, the statin dosing is actually not different. So if you'd given me that answer, I would have accepted it on the test. But yes, I think the main take home here is that protease inhibitors do have a big interaction with statins, and we need to be careful in using those agents together. Okay, but I think statins are very important, and we need to make sure we're utilizing statins appropriately. And so I just showed you some data about these high-risk plaques in the setting of HIV. And so here's a study from Janet Lowe, with whom I work. She's at Harvard, and where she looked at atorvastatin to see if it would reduce plaque burden in people with HIV. And the first thing that she did is she took people with HIV and without HIV, and she looked at the plaque burden, matched these people. And 53% of the HIV group versus only 35% of the HIV negative had these high-risk plaques. So right off the bat, HIV, once again, associated with a greater burden of disease when matched to HIV negative controls. And then interestingly as well, what we have here, this is actually a person who got the placebo in her study, but you can see someone had this plaque. I think you can recognize that. Then after 12 months, this person had progressed as an HIV-infected individual, progressed significantly in this plaque burden. And when she looked at the whole population, what she saw is the placebo actually had an increase in plaque burden in that relatively short period of time versus the ones who had atorvastatin had a significant decrease. And the decrease in plaque burden was beyond what was expected with just LDL lowering alone, really suggesting that there's other sort of pleiotropic benefit, anti-inflammatory benefit of statins. And that's one of the things that we need to better understand. I think, you know, statins are in the press a lot. And, you know, should we put them in the water? That's a question that, you know, I don't know yet. But I do think that we need to understand, particularly if they have anti-inflammatory processes, mechanisms, is that really important for people with HIV? And I think it's an outstanding question. In 2015, I got to serve on a panel for the NLA to really recognize. This was the first time that the NLA had recognized HIV as a high-risk group for cardiovascular disease. And so this was kind of very exciting. All of a sudden, we were getting pulled to the forefront and very important for that. I think that one of the things, our key recommendations was that we need to recognize that our patients are at increased risk of cardiovascular disease. And this risk is likely independent of other risk factors. It may be interrelated with them, but it probably is independent related to this chronic viral infection. We should be checking a fasting lipid panel in our new HIV patients so we know what their baseline is, and then we can use that as a tool to guide the patient-provider discussion around cardiovascular risk reduction. HIV may be considered as an additional risk factor as we're counseling our patients. And then statin should be the first-line therapy for elevated LDL cholesterol and non-HDL cholesterol. Non-HDL cholesterol is where you basically take the total cholesterol and subtract the HDL, and that can be used as a surrogate as well. Drug-drug interactions must be considered, and the recommendations are atorvastatin, rosuvastatin, and pitavastatin as preferred agents because of proven efficacy in terms of lipid-lowering therapy, as well as minimal drug-drug interactions that can be addressed as well. Along those lines, many of you people, anybody here participating in the REPRIEVE trial? So shameless plug for the, I know Kentucky is, yes ma'am. So shameless plug, there's no data to inform primary prevention of using statins in HIV. All the data is surrogate data, either looking at biomarkers of inflammation or cardiovascular disease or these imaging surrogate markers, but no hard data on true endpoints. So the REPRIEVE trial is a trial that's funded by NHLBI and run through the AIDS Clinical Trials Group, where we're looking at people with HIV who are on antiretroviral therapy with a low to moderate risk of cardiovascular disease, and we're randomizing them to statin or placebo. And we're going to follow them for 7 years. But not only are we going to have data about cardiovascular disease, but also many of these other surrogate endpoints where it may be relevant to receive a statin. Okay, I have another question. Which statement about the metabolic syndrome is accurate? The metabolic syndrome is not applicable to persons with HIV. The metabolic syndrome is correlated with cardiovascular disease risk. The metabolic syndrome predisposes patients to chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Persons with the metabolic syndrome should be referred to a neurologist for neurocognitive testing. I am currently in the metabolic syndrome because of the delicious desserts that Donna Jacobson provided lunch. Okay, so you know five is wrong because Donna didn't give us lunch. But you have the other four. If only. Okay. Excellent, excellent. Okay, so you guys are good clinicians. You know about the metabolic syndrome, and that's wonderful. I'm not going to talk about that anymore here, but I am going to talk about it a little bit in my breakout session, so I'm certainly hoping that you guys will elect to come spend your free hour with me this afternoon. It is really critical that we remember some simple things, the ABCDEs about cardiovascular disease risk reduction. And so I've listed those here, and these are the things that we as primary care providers for our HIV patients need to be thinking of. Aspirin use for primary prevention. These previously were more complex, and the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has simplified these down to really identify those people who are most likely to benefit. And those people are individuals who fall in these age groups between 50 and 69 with a 10% cardiovascular, 10-year cardiovascular disease risk. And they should be considered for low-dose aspirin in primary cardiovascular disease prevention. The other groups are excluded because there's inadequate data and there's concern specifically for safety in the older patients. But there may be benefit for our patients. I will just say that we've looked in our clinic and in a cross-sectional manner, and we found is less than 1 in 5 individuals who actually met criteria for a low-dose aspirin was receiving it. You can see here in this figure that as people accrued cardiovascular comorbidities or risk comorbidities, you see an increase. So if you had, for every one additional risk factor you accrued, you had a twofold increased odds of receiving aspirin. Nevertheless, the take-home message is that we're underutilizing aspirin in this group. Okay, I mentioned adherence to antiretroviral therapy and keeping undetectable, but we have all these other issues that I think we fail to address in a routine manner. Tobacco use is first and foremost, and I think you guys recognize that right off the bat. Our patients smoke two or more times, more likely to smoke than the general population. And this is still the leading cause of preventable mortality in this country. From the VA cohort, they looked at risk factors for all-cause mortality, and the three items that came out were age, lower CD4 count, and smoking. And so once again, we can't do anything about people's age. We're doing everything we can for their CD4 count, but smoking is something we need to aggressively address in our patients, both for their overall health as well as cardiovascular disease risk. Lifestyle modification. So the most recent update from the ACC-AHA about diet modification recognizes that this is a challenge, but also recognizes modest changes can have pretty big benefits. And so what they really altered their view to is really talking to people about dietary patterns. And we'll talk about that more in the breakout session, but really modest changes can have big benefits. Now, there's limited data in HIV, but I pulled some data from pre-diabetics here, where basically if you cut 500 calories per day, you can decrease significant weight. And really, this can maybe just be as simple as watching portion size or cutting liquid calories, avoiding foods in boxes and cans. And so here you have an 8-week intervention for pre-diabetic, obese, HIV-negative individuals. And you see with this intervention, significant 4.5 kilogram weight loss, 6% weight loss in this short period of time. And this actually was associated with a number of different biomarkers of inflammation reduction as well. So for patients that have a predisposing inflammatory state, this type of intervention may be very effective. Exercise. So, you know, I think that for many of our patients, having a sedentary lifestyle is a big challenge for various reasons. Maybe they don't have a safe place to exercise. The most recent guidelines actually recommend, you know, any movement is better than none, and so really trying to meet our patients where they are. These are some basic goals that can have big benefits for our patients. There are a growing number of studies that are showing the benefits of exercise for HIV patients in terms of their physical performance, frailty prevention, neurocognitive performance, as well as inflammatory biomarkers. I'm just going to show this one study. This was just published in HIV Clinical Trials, and it's a small study. But basically what they did is they randomized individuals to receive 8-week intervention that included either aerobic, resistance, or combined. And the notable thing is that all three of these interventions, if a person stuck with it, showed benefits in terms of muscular strength and cardiopulmonary function. What I'm showing on these two graphs are a reduction or an improvement in mitochondrial function through reduced oxidative stress. So once again, if you're thinking about the pathways that HIV may contribute to excess inflammation, some of the mitochondrial toxicity, and this has implications for muscle function, cardiovascular disease, et cetera, a modest intervention can actually have big implications in terms of overall health and reduced cardiovascular disease risk. So, you know, I know I really just dip down and touch down on the surface. But I think that we need to be recognizing with our success of antiretroviral therapy and reducing HIV viremia and AIDS-related complications, we're seeing a new emergence of non-AIDS comorbidities, including cardiovascular disease. And HIV itself, even controlled HIV, may contribute to cardiovascular disease risk. Controlling HIV disease is first and foremost critical. And if we treat people early, I didn't go over the data, but there is data that if we start people on antiretroviral therapy at a very high CD4 count above 500, we may mitigate some of the cardiovascular risk and vascular inflammation that we see. We don't currently have reliable inflammatory biomarkers to identify those at highest risk, and currently available risk scores underestimate the risk in HIV. And I'm going to show some examples this afternoon of the use of the risk score, and I'll talk about how I actually use that tool in the clinical setting. Smoking cessation, dietary changes, and exercise are three interventions that we all should be working on with our patients regularly to try to improve their health and reduce cardiovascular disease. Statins clearly provide benefit in terms of lipid improvements and perhaps in inflammatory pathways. Reprieve will tell us about primary prevention in the setting of HIV, and furthermore identify other potential benefits for statins and mechanisms beyond LDL lowering that may improve cardiovascular disease. We need more data to inform the use of statins in what are considered traditional low-risk populations, like HIV individuals with low risk scores. So I thank you guys for bearing with me right after lunch, and I'm happy to take any questions.
So anyone want to come up to the microphone? Does increased vascular inflammation cause erectile dysfunction?
So that's a good question. Yes, there are similar pathways that can contribute, obviously, to erectile dysfunction. Whether that is actual vascular inflammation or potentially just the atherosclerosis that occurs, and we note that with smoking, I can't say specifically, but I would assume that, yes, it probably is a similar pathway.
Okay, so this is a question. How do we factor in chronic use of amphetamines when considering cardiovascular risk? And I have a patient that only has heart attacks when she uses cocaine. I do. So, you know, how do we factor those things in?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good, a very important thing. I didn't go into this. There are, there's a recognition there are two different types of heart attacks or cardiac events. Number one is a type one, which is the traditional where you have a plaque that ruptures. The second is where you have more of a vasospasm, and that's related more to cocaine or sepsis or something like that. And what's notable is in HIV, you have about a 50% of the MIs that we see, at least in the Scenix cohort, that are type 1 and 50% that are type 2. So really, if we can mitigate, I didn't even talk about illicit substances, but that is a big risk factor, particularly amphetamines and cocaine, that can be driving acute events, but also chronic vascular inflammation.
Great. So what is your goal LDL for someone with HIV? If you start statins, what's the goal?
So that's a great question. I can't tell you what my goal is unless I know other risk attributes of that person. So I can tell you for the high-risk group, the goal is an LDL of 70 or a 50% reduction. However, with someone with more moderate risk, it may just be a 30% reduction. So there is some risk-based goal there.
Okay, and for patients that are long-term non-progressors, do you recommend ART for the reasons of that you've described in terms of
risk? Oh, that's a great question. So for long-term non-progressors, there are data that are available that, number one, they have greater amounts of systemic and vascular inflammation, and they still have a higher risk of cardiovascular events. Whether or not antiretroviral therapy is enough to mitigate that is unclear. I think we need more data in that area. That's a no data zone.
And are there particular antiretrovirals that are associated with a cardiovascular disease that we should be particularly concerned about? Like among the PIs?
Yeah, I would avoid Indinavir. Is anyone using Indinavir? I think that's a great question. I'm not convinced about the abacavir data. That being said, you know, I think that if I have an alternative and I have someone that's a high risk, I might elect to use that. I think in terms of other agents that are of concern, personally, I avoid booster agents in patients with a higher risk, and maybe it's not so much because of direct risk of cardiovascular disease, but more because I'm worried about the effects on the lipids and insulin sensitivity.
Is there a reason to avoid oral contraceptives for women with HIV because of this increased thrombotic risk?
I think you follow the guidelines for that. I think one of the big things that we try to talk to our, and maybe I think a bigger concern are for our trans women in terms of hormone replacement therapy and thinking about if they less so about their HIV and more about smoking. So for those individuals who smoke, that's where I'm reticent to use the oral contraceptives.
And is COBE associated with increased LDL? And likewise, does Norvir or COBE increase the cardiovascular risk at all when used as boosters?
So that's a good question. I don't think we have good data on cobicistat, which is the booster in a lot of the co-formulation. If I can, I avoid that for several reasons, but mainly because of my concern for, as I mentioned, lipids and insulin resistance effects, and so it may be an indirect effect on cardiovascular disease. I also worry about drug-drug interactions. It's my patient's age. Are they going to have some other agent they need to be on that now I've got an interaction to worry about?
And could you talk about using the cardiovascular risk calculators that are available for and how to modify them for someone living with HIV?
Yeah, so I don't know that we have good modifying risk tools, but I will be happy to talk about that, and I have some slides in my breakout session that I think can help us work through how to use the tool and so you personalize it for your patients.
And are there guidelines for lipid control for people living with HIV? Is that in the guidelines anywhere?
Yes. So there are a couple of different. So I showed you what the NLA did in 2015, as well as the most recent guidelines that came out in October, specifically recognize HIV as a group with higher risk. So I think it's exciting that we're getting recognized in these subspecialties, and that means there's funds available for us to do more research in that area and really answer key questions.
Great. Thank you so much.
Oh, sure.
Thank you.
Do you want to let these people?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Well, let's take 3 minutes. I'm sorry. I didn't look up at all. I was trying to get through them. Sorry about that.
We've looked at periodontal disease as an independent risk factor for HIV, for cardiovascular disease in people with HIV.
So not specifically. So the question was about periodontal disease, and that clearly is a risk factor in the general population, and I assume that it's the same, and we do see higher rates of periodontal disease in our patients. Yes, sir.
I have a comment rather than a question, sorry. But my smokers have taught me this, and that is to use the nicotine patches and ignore the warning that it says do not smoke when you're wearing the patch. Because I did some looking around. There's really no one that dies from nicotine overdose. It's cigarette smoke. Second thing they passed along to me was big red gum does not go with cigarettes. So after coffee or after meals or getting in a car, if they pop in some big red gum, the last thing they want to do is smoke a cigarette. Apparently, it's really disgusting.
Right. And that can also prevent your high school English teacher from smelling the smoke as you come into class. I'm happy to be around for questions, or I'll hopefully see some of you this afternoon at the session.
Yeah, we had lots of other questions that we couldn't get to, so thank you so much.